You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm processing Putin's speech from last night, which is it's taking time.
Yeah,
well, updating the news feeds.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about. Yeah. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. And you are Nikita Petrov. You're a Russian. You live in St. Petersburg. Is that where you are now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And you do some work for me, but that's not really the reason you're here. I just wanted to get a Russian's reaction to what's going on in Ukraine. And you're interesting to me because I don't want to say you're just a regular Russian. You're in many ways a highly irregular person, Nikita, but you're not some kind of commentator. I don't even think of you as you're not like some kind of politics junkie. You pay attention to the news, but your interests are more in areas like art and culture. You're probably, at the same time, I don't want to say you're kind of a typical Russian. There are different subcultures in Russia, just as there are in other countries. But anyway, I thought it would be interesting to hear how you're processing this. Let me just tell people what's happened at the moment we're recording this. Russia has recognized the two breakaway republics in the Donbass region of Ukraine. Putin has, I think the troops have crossed the border. He sent troops in. And of course, by recognizing them, that means that in his view, this isn't technically an invasion, but it is a violation of international law, for the record, in my view. I suspect there's going to be fighting and he's going to push the separatist held parts of these two republics all the way to the borders of the republics. Right now, the separatists only control about a third of the total area. That's my guess. We don't know. I'd be shocked if there's not fighting. I mean, so in other words, I think we are now going to have some version of the war that people have dreaded. And Putin last night gave this speech, which I actually haven't read. It's being depicted in the West as him being crazy and unhinged. On the other hand, our coverage tends to, kind of have that coloration to it when we're talking about Putin. He was already being depicted as crazy and unhinged. And I don't actually think he had done that many things that required that interpretation. But with that as background, before you talk about the speech, quickly, do you want to try to situate yourself in kind of Russian society? I mean, in other words, what kind of people do you hang out with? You're not, it's safe to say you're not a hardcore Putin supporter. In fact, I think you've been at demonstrations at some point in your life that would suggest otherwise.
Before it became extremism.
Before that became extremism, yeah. You were, yeah. And that's one thing that actually has kind of happened. It's considered riskier now.
I mean, pick your threshold, pick your date. We might use Navalny's return to Russia was another turn to more reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's riskier. There are more cases, more people are in jail, more people have left the country. Right now, we've been having these conversations every, I don't know, a year or so. You and I catch up on the state of affairs in Russia, and it's getting darker. Right now, I mean, the first of these we talked, there was an oppositional movement. There's not an oppositional movement anymore. Everybody who is kind of an oppositional figure is either jailed or dead or outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the last big protests that happened were when Navalny came back and was jailed. And some people are, in jail after those protests. And mm-hmm. And then others are afraid to, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with this. Somebody, you know, filed a, registered a rally, like an anti-war rally, but the people who filed it are not, I don't know, we'll see. I doubt a lot of people will show up just because it's become so risky.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you, so what, did you listen to the speech?
I did twice. I listened yesterday when he was giving the speech on sped up, because I started listening when he was already had been talking for 20 or 30 minutes. And my girlfriend was struggling with that being in the background. So I just sped it up. And then today I listened to it on at normal speed. It's weird. It's one of the weirder. It's troubling. It's, you know, by the end of it, that was my reaction. And then I saw that many people had the same reaction. And by the end of it, when it the last few minutes, he finally said, so we're going to recognize the breakaway republics. I almost felt like phew, because for a minute it sounded like he's going to end with, we're not going to recognize Ukraine as a country anymore. He gave this long view of history, his version of the history of the 20th century. And it sounded like, you know, to begin with, Ukraine as we know it now, the borders that it has is a consequence of a series of errors on the part of the Soviet leadership. He said that Ukraine could be called, like it should have in the title a reference to Lenin, because he's the architect. He's the reason they have Donbass to begin mm-hmm. with. And then Stalin gave them some German and Polish territory, and then Khrushchev gave them Crimea. And I think from the, you know, context of the speech sounded like he treats the Soviet leaders as leaders of Russia. Like, you know, Lenin was an internationalist. Mm. The Bolsheviks wanted a world revolution. They were not, the original idea was not to take over the Russian Empire, put a different flag on top of it and do Russian Empire 2.0. But in Putin's view, it sounded like Soviet leaders are Russian leaders. And so whatever Ukraine has, this is what Russian leaders gave them. That's, you know, to begin with. And then,
so in other words, kind of Russian leaders giveth and Russian leaders can taketh away. I mean,
well, he said one line that was disturbing. He said, so he credited Lenin with designing Ukraine. And then he said, now they're toppling Lenin statues, and they're calling it decommunization. Well, if you want decommunization, we can show you what that is. You know, if you want to go that way, go all the way.
He means who is toppling the statues?
Oh, in Ukraine, there's been this process of
the Ukrainian nationalists are toppling statues of Russians.
I wouldn't say nationalists. That's what happens in post-Soviet republics. First, you have a lot of Lenin statues, and then you start to get rid of them.
But I mean, the people in Ukraine who identify closely with Russia, we might call them the ethnic Russians or the natively Russian-speaking Ukrainians or whatever, they're probably not the ones toppling the statues, mainly. The statues aren't being toppled in the Donbass, probably, or at least not in the parts held by
I separate. Wonder, I don't know how many Lenin statues are left in Ukraine, but okay. It's been I'm pretty sure that, you know, at least okay. some Lenin statues in the East were taken down as well.
Okay. So, you know, one thing I wondered, you know, people said, well, he's saying Ukraine isn't real. So he's clearly going to tear the whole thing apart or occupy the whole thing or something. That's some reaction. I was wondering whether actually this is mainly about justifying just the occupation of the Donbass, and again, probably military action, at least to the extent of the borders of these two republics, which could get a lot of people killed, of course, but it's different from occupying Kiev. And so what you're saying is that given how dramatically he'd set it up and given how thoroughly he had questioned the very authentic coherence of Ukraine, you were almost relieved when at the end he said, I'm just recognizing these two republics.
Well, because it took an hour for him to get to the point, right? Mm-hmm. He gave this whole lecture on the history of the 20th century where, you know, he said what I just tried to relay about the kind of foundations of Ukraine. And he says that Ukraine now is a puppet regime. It's really the United States that are calling the shots, to the extent that like military orders are taken from NATO commanders. You know, this is just completely, it's not its own state. And so, you know, after 55 minutes of that, it sounded scary. And then at the end when he said it did sound, I mean, maybe that's the theatrics of it. Maybe he wanted to ramp it mm-hmm. up at first and then calm it down a little bit, or to keep you on the edge of your seat. And, you know, I'm still not sure. Like you say, is occupation of Kyiv a possibility? 2 weeks ago, I would say this is crazy. But now, I don't know, I was just kind of shocked by the speech. And now I'm not sure what, I mean, I still think it's highly, highly unlikely, would be disastrous. It doesn't make any sense to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, he's playing a weird, risky game.
There is one kind of theme in recent coverage of Russia here has been, you know, I mean, there have always been people who depicted him as crazy or irrational in ways I thought just didn't make sense. I mean, he's always seemed to me a person who took calculated risks, but never overplayed his hand in a fundamental way. Is fundamentally a rational, self-interested politician. But lately there's been this theme that, well, maybe during COVID he's gotten crazier or something. Is this something that Russians are, is it something they were saying, first of all, before the speech? Has this been a thing in Russia? He's getting weirder?
I mean, the reality has been getting weirder, right? With COVID, with Putin, like the most obvious superficial, I suppose, thing, but still it leaves a mark, is with the danger of COVID, he's been doing these, like, he's not meeting people face to face. So when Macron showed up, I mean, so Putin was talking to Macron. Macron came to Russia. I first saw the picture, and many people have made fun of it. There's this incredibly long
big table, right,
and they're sitting on the opposite sides of it. That seemed bizarre. Then I saw the headline in the news explaining the long table, and it was, we can't afford for a foreign government to have our president's DNA.
And
we can't afford for a foreign government to have access to the president's DNA.
Wait, who said that? The government didn't say that, did they?
So I saw the headline. I thought Putin is losing his fucking marbles. Then I clicked on the article. Turns out that was the French side explaining why they were sitting at this table. So apparently Macron was offered to either get the PCR test, the nose swab, mm-hmm. Or to sit at the long table, and they declined the test because Russians might steal Macron's DNA, and who knows what they're going to do with that. So reality has been getting weird. Like, the idea of Russia's absurd, or Russian authorities said something weird, I'm used to that. But in this case, you know, my expectations were, you know, I was surprised to see that it's not our side. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah, these long distances, there are many shots of different, like he's, it was Christmas. He's in the temple alone. He went to pay respects to the people who died in the Second World War. He's alone at the graveyard. He's doing this, the yesterday's events. First, there was this weird, also kind of theatrical thing where the members of the government one by one were asking him to recognize the republics. He asked them to provide their opinion. He said, you all know I haven't talked to you about this before. Right. I want your blunt opinion. What do you think? And so then one by one, they had to do this thing. One of them got confused as to what he has to say. And it was...
I saw that.
And so all of that happened also like...
Go ahead and tell that story. It's kind of funny. The one guy maybe was a few weeks ahead in the playbook when he said, yes, I'm in favor of Russia absorbing the two republics. And Putin said, no, we're not talking about that. We're talking about recognizing their independence.
There was this whole back and forth. He starts saying... at first he starts saying, I agree that maybe we should give the West one last chance for, you know, diplomacy to, and Putin's like, wait, so you're saying we should start the negotiation process. And then the guy, you see the fear in his eyes and he's like, well, I mean, yeah, we should, I would support the motion. And Putin says, you would, or you are supporting the motion? He's like, I am. So then say it. Okay, yes, I am saying I am supporting the motion to accept the Donetsk and the Luhansk People's Republic into Russia. And Putin says, that's not what we're talking about, though. We're talking about their independence. Not so, you know, there was this whole parade of these people saying, please. And then at the end, he says, I heard you. I'm going to go think about it. And then I'll deliver the decision by the end of today.
Do you think most Russians, like, they watch this and they don't realize it's totally choreographed and that Putin basically told them, this is what you say, and then I'm going to pretend I'm going to think about it?
You know, it could be that he didn't tell them that. It could be that it was their job to understand that's what they need to say. I mean, this is not very difficult to guess what's expected. It could be one... one comment that I saw was that the people in the room, the people who were given these, asking him to recognize the republic, they're not really on the same team. Each of them is on the same team with Putin, and that's what they need to establish in that meeting. They need to show loyalty. They need to say, I will support you. But they themselves aren't necessarily friends. And so it could be his way of, you know, psychologically dominating his own government, mm-hmm. you know, to make them, you know, play this out, to do this ritual.
This was some kind of National Security Council or something? These were people from different regions?
No, this is the federal government, different
the cabinet.
Branches. Yeah.
So... do you have first of all, let me ask you, since the speech, have you kind of checked in with your friends online? I mean, let's talk for starters about just your milieu, which of course is not representative of Russia at large, but it's representative of something. You're relatively cosmopolitan, younger than the average Russian, well-educated. Have you gotten a sense for how your crowd is processing this?
Yeah, all of the reactions that I've seen are people are alarmed and confused and are worried about the future.
Worried about what he's going to do in Ukraine mainly, or just we're starting to worry about his stability, or?
The speech was Cold War rhetoric that I don't think we've seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's saying that Ukraine is not a real state. It's a puppet state controlled by the Americans. Mm-hmm. Americans have been, expanding NATO eastwards, breaking all their promises. Ukraine, so Zelensky said something the other day. He was complaining about the West, that he's not getting enough support from the mm-hmm. West. They're doing this lip service, but
this,
not.
This is the president of Ukraine, of course. Yeah,
that's right.
Go ahead.
And in those remarks, he said, "Listen, we gave up the nuclear weapons in 1994 with the understanding that our borders are going to be respected. This was, you know, the exchange. If you guys, the West, are not going to back us up in this crisis and not just talk about it, but actually help us maintain the integrity of the territory, we might give up that promise. So Zelensky's saying maybe Ukraine is going to develop its own nuclear program. Now, in Putin's, the worldview that he outlined in the speech yesterday, Ukraine is not its own state. It's an arm of the United States. So if they're saying we're going to have nuclear weapons, that's the United States saying there are going to be nuclear weapons at Russia's border.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't heard that from him, that, you know, we're now talking about a nuclear war, you know, America versus Russia, with Ukraine playing, you know, a kind of subservient role on behalf of the USA. And then what he does, we don't know. So again, first, as of now, they said they recognize the breakaway republics. There have been follow-ups. Which borders do you mean? The borders that they currently are in, or the borders of the regions which they only control, you know, a third of?
Mm-hmm.
And there hasn't been a clear answer yet. The latest that I saw just an hour ago, the foreign ministry said this is not a question that is solved in a day.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to watch. So if they, if it's the entire region, then I don't see how you do that without fighting. If there's fighting, then this is Russians and Ukrainians killing each other. This is Russian army officially engaged mm-hmm. in warfare with Ukrainian army. And by, you know, Western metrics, that's an invasion of Ukraine. And all of that can happen right about now. And then who knows what the next step is going to be, what reaction is going to be from the West, what sanctions they impose. What Putin does in response to those.
Yeah, I think he may pause, but if he thinks that then he's going to get the concessions he had hoped for, I think he's confused, because I think the politics in the West will permit that even less than they permitted it before. So you mentioned his, you know, so again, I think there is going to be fighting, and I would guess he's going to push the borders all the way out to what are the borders of those two provinces, right, republics, whatever. And that's a long way. And there's a lot of Ukrainian soldiers standing in between him and those borders. So it could get pretty bad. Right. So you said he considers Ukraine an arm of the West. Now, I know a big moment for him in his psychology is the 2014 deposing of the president of Ukraine, who was pretty pro-Russian, and I know a big thing for Putin is the fact that there was American involvement in that. I mean, kind of famously, there's a tape, the Russians apparently taped a phone conversation, unbeknownst to the participants, Victoria Nuland, a U.S. State Department official, mm-hmm. and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, where they were talking before the president was deposed about who should succeed him.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, it shouldn't be this guy, because he's like this. It should be this guy. And this guy did indeed become not president, but prime minister. And that's what they were talking about. It made him for a time, I think, in effect, the head of the government. And so it seemed as if, I mean, in addition, you know, Victoria Nuland was kind of in a showy way, walking around the Maidan, passing cookies out to the protesters, the anti-president protesters, before it turned violent. And there's now, you know, the Western story is that what happened is that the president's troops fired on the protesters. The other side of the story is there were provocateurs, false flags, something or other, whatever. But I'm sure that's the version that Putin buys. So there really was Western involvement in this. And if you listen to that phone conversation, I'll tell you, it sounds like two American officials are basically, they think they can call the shots. They really, it's clear. They think they can decide who is going to run the government after this president leaves, and then he did leave for fear of his life, armed opponents roaming the streets, he fled. So from Russia's point of view, it looks like an American-sponsored coup. That's whatever the truth is, that's not to me a surprising interpretation. It's not surprising that Putin would have that interpretation given the evidence. I'm wondering, did that get a ton of attention in Russia, as you recall? That was a while ago now, 8 years ago now. You would have been, maybe just out of college or something, but...
Specifically, as an old conversation, I don't remember that bit, but that's not the only thing you can point to. I mean, John McCain was on stage at the Maidan, it was a turn to, the U.S. and the EU, and the new government was subsidized by the West. My mother, she's Ukrainian, half Ukrainian. She's from Ukraine. Mm. She watches a lot of Ukrainian TV, which I think is, I keep telling her, don't watch either Russian or Ukrainian TV. Either one of those is not good for you, but she does. And she reports to me what it's like on Ukrainian TV. And she said that for a while it was really like that was the new, not even just the government, just like that of that movement's kind of attitude, that we are trying to integrate with the West. We're going to get the money. We're going to do what they say we need to do to get the money. Mm-hmm. The people on that side would say this is not, this is a civilizational choice. Ukraine wants to be integrated with the West. And in order to do that, they need to make these agreements and, follow something that might sound like orders at times, try to find its way, try to establish sovereignty. But the issue at hand is to get into EU, to get into NATO, and compromises need to be made, or conditions. The West might have conditions that you need to follow. But there's clearly a turn to the West, and
which is not supported by all Ukrainians, but a lot of them, especially in Western Ukraine.
Yeah, I actually don't know. I haven't been in Ukraine in a long time. I don't know how it is now. I'm sure, 8 years of war has changed something, that there's probably been, migration and people changing their minds. And I don't know how the edges in the East have changed, if they changed a lot. But there is the traditional kind of narrative is the East is pro-Russian, the West is pro-West. And I don't know how it's been changing, what the dynamics of it is now.
So your mother had one Russian parent, one ethnically Russian parent, and one ethnically Ukrainian parent?
That's right. And she was born in a Ukrainian village.
In what part of Ukraine, East or West? Was it more of a Russian-oriented?
Actually, I'm actually not sure. I think it was in the West. I think it was like the original. I mean, she traveled around a lot, and she lived in Kazakhstan and when she was a teenager. But originally, she's from a Ukrainian village.
And what is her view of this whole thing? Have you talked to her since? You haven't talked to her since the speech, probably. But
I have exchanged a few messages. I mean, it's like a train wreck, a runaway. You're watching it, and you're just hoping for the best. But I don't know how good it's going to be, and she's in the same. She said she was very concerned after she saw the speech. She said her comparison was, this is Stalin in his late stages, where he's completely paranoid. Everybody's against him. And he's encircled by the enemies. He sees enemies everywhere. And her assessment was, the man's losing his marbles. Huh. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if it's new. I don't know how much of what he says he truly believes and how much of it is rhetoric. It's hard to say. It kind of sounds like the worldview that he outlined kind of sounds like he actually thinks that. I don't know if that's new. Maybe he's just bolder in saying it.
And do you think your mother, because of her kind of mixed heritage, has you know, a somewhat objective view. In other words, is she, you don't associate her particularly with, on the one hand, staunchly pro-Russian nationalists, or on the other hand, as being, you know, some kind of secret Ukrainian, pro-Ukrainian agitator or something, right? I mean, in other words, her view of the speech, that it's really alarming, is not coming from, you would find it credible based on her, I don't know what even question I'm asking. Do you want to say anything in response to this?
Yeah, this is not about really the relationship between the Ukrainians and Russians. You know, this is politicians possibly starting a war that may, you know, go further than the original conceptions of it.
Yeah.
That's the fear. Nobody wants a war. I don't think people in Ukraine or in Russia want a war. And that's scary. And so when people start talking about nuclear weapons at the border of the country and how, you know, it's like Russia versus America, that's just scary.
Yeah. I would have thought that what he meant by that is, look, America is going to turn Ukraine into a base for nuclear missiles. And that's why we cannot tolerate like Ukraine getting into NATO and blah, blah, right. blah. And that's why I have to right. act. I wouldn't have necessarily taken that as some kind of threat that this could go nuclear, but maybe I didn't see it on the other hand. I'm just
going to. Well, he was saying, I think you're right in the message of it, but you know, he listed particular carriers, like missile carriers that they have. And this one takes 4 minutes to get to most of Western Russia. It's just, again, we haven't heard much of that like really alarmist rhetoric.
Yeah, well, see, we are putting an anti-missile system within 100 miles of the Russian border in Poland. And although technically it's a defensive weapon, and we say it's actually... It's for intercepting Iranian missiles. Well, fine, but it can obviously be used to intercept any kind of missiles. And although it's technically a defensive weapon, he would be right to think, well, yeah, but it can have offensive purposes. If you were going to attack us, yeah, well, it does.
He's been saying that. Yeah.
If you are going to attack us, it's going to help you that you can shoot down any missiles we fire in response. Defensive weapons are offensive weapons. Now, so I guess my perspective is, I mean, and I'm interested, I'd be interested to hear how conscious you've been of the whole NATO expansion issue. I mean, I remember the 1990s when we started expanding NATO and some very wise voices in the American foreign policy establishment, mm-hmm. back when I think the establishment, frankly, was wiser than it is now, were mm-hmm. saying, this is crazy. Don't expand it one inch toward the east, you know, beyond Eastern Germany, at least. Russia will find this threatening. George Kennan, the guy who, the architect of the containment doctrine, said, this is crazy. Then again, you know, other people said that. Matlock, who had been the ambassador to the Soviet Union, said that. He had been like Reagan's guy. He was not some kind of dove. He said, this is crazy. It will only lead to trouble. In 2008, Bill Burns, who is now the director of the CIA, sent a memo. This was, 2008 was the fateful year when George W. Bush, we had already added a bunch of countries to NATO, and George W. Bush said, we want to pledge that we will eventually let Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And right. he kind of strong-armed the Europeans into accepting that. They didn't want to accept it. Bill Burns, who is now head of the CIA, sent a memo to Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State. He said, this is a red line for Russia. And he explicitly said, it's not just Putin. He said, believe me, everyone in the national security establishment, all Russian elites, think Ukraine is an absolute red line. If you promise to let Ukraine into NATO, it will be a huge fucking mistake. And he even said, Russia will start meddling in Eastern. What he said is this will be fertile ground for Russia to meddle into Eastern Ukraine. So, you know, from my point of view, we've been asking for this kind of trouble. Wiser heads warned about it. And I'm wondering, again, you're not a super politically plugged in person. You've never had aspirations, I think, to be a political journalist or to be this or to be that. You know, but you, as just a Russian who pays attention, have you been aware over the last 10, 15 years and going
Absolutely,
back to
your
what does this all look like from your perspective?
What you're saying, basically. No Russian wants more NATO bases around the country, for sure. I actually haven't heard a good counter-narrative. Like, what Putin keeps saying is, listen, they tell us this is all defensive, this is not against you. Then I'm asking, well, who is it against then? And why is it at our borders? And they don't have a good response. Right. Is there a good answer to that?
No, there's not. I mean, nobody, in other words, you can imagine someone having outlined an alternative use of NATO. Like, you know, I don't remember one. When Clinton launched the
counterterrorism, I think I've heard. Yeah.
I'll tell you what I think maybe the most common rationale was, that it was a way of consolidating the gains for democracy and mm-hmm. free market, you know, economic and political liberalism. Like, as these Eastern European, they seem to be moving to our model, democracy, free market. If we put them in NATO, that will kind of somehow consolidate the gain. Now, first of all, the current situation in Hungary suggests you're wrong. We're all screaming about how illiberal Hungary is. Well, it's in NATO. Apparently, that didn't help. But the other issue is, let's look at the cost here. I mean, it's in terms of Russia's perception and in terms of exactly what we're seeing. And what's sad is that now, America, having made, I think, so many missteps, including the, in effect, intervention in a kind of intervention, not military, but a kind of intervention in Ukrainian politics in 2014, but certainly the expansion of NATO. Now, everyone, the way Putin is behaving will allow Americans to just ignore all that, right? It's like, this has nothing to do with us. It's just a crazy Russian leader. Whereas, probably, if we hadn't ever expanded NATO, we'd be in an extremely different place. I do think Ukraine was going to become a delicate situation in any event. And I think he is threatened there, not just by NATO membership, but by EU affiliation. And I think there what you needed was some kind of delicate compromise where some kind of affiliation with the EU could have happened without it coming at the expense of Russia's economic relationship with Ukraine. But I gather that the EU was kind of not open to that kind of compromise. Anyway, I'm just venting about the U.S. foreign policy establishment, so I'll stop. But it's interesting that you have been, this has been a real thing, the NATO expansion thing in Russia. Everyone's kind of been aware of it.
Of course, the NATO expansion, then the other part of this narrative is the quote-unquote orange revolutions. This is in reference to the, or not color revolutions. So
yeah.
In Ukraine, it was the orange revolution. In Georgia, forget what they called it. But the narrative is these are not revolutions. These are coups. There is a methodology to staging these, you stage public unrest, you take advantage of it, you install your own, a government that's sympathetic to you. What's happening with Ukraine is very similar, I suppose, to what happened with Georgia. So there was a revolution. There was a pro-Western government installed after the revolution. There are disputed territories. The war of 2008 was, there was, the way I remember it, it was pretty clear that Georgia did attack the capital of South Ossetia. And then Russia, having previously given out passports, Russian passports, to a lot of the population of South Ossetia,
right,
moved in, secured the region. That was, though, a long conflict. That was like Georgia versus South Ossetia, that's in Abkhazia. Those were long-standing conflicts from the beginning of the 90s. And it was in 2008 that Russia recognized Abkhazia and South Ossetia as independent states. Mm-hmm. And now they're there. I was in Abkhazia last summer. It was a weird experience because the world, as far as the world is concerned, I was in Georgia. As far as my iPhone is concerned, I'm in Georgia. My, you know, when I look at geolocation, the phone tells me I'm in Georgia. I was clearly not in Georgia because, you know, it's Russian rubles, it's Abkhazian flags. Apparently not a whole lot of Georgians present because they still have, you know, their issues. But it's just there. It's this region that they think they're Abkhazia, the world thinks they're Georgia. And this might be the scenario that this goes down now with Ukraine. Putin secures these two regions, recognizes them as independent states. They become these buffer zones. The world thinks this is Ukraine. Russia says they're independent states. Russia subsidizes them heavily. And they're just there.
And probably keeps troops there. Which right. There are not in South Ossetia now, right? There are not Russian troops, or
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, it's peace. There's no war there.
So the color revolution you referred to, now that happened before 2014, when Ukraine in effect, I guess, became a democracy, maybe, and deposed an authoritarian.
I mean, ostensibly they were democracy. They were as much democratic as Russia at the time.
Okay, so maybe I'm confused about that, but the color revolution per se was before 2014. And my question is, was it your, so you're saying going that far back, I don't know what year that was, going that far back, I guess that what happened with the color revolution was a pro-Russian leader was deposed, was replaced with a pro-Western leader maybe. Is it a widespread? Go ahead.
It was an election that... the protesters claimed was rigged. So they said that the pro-Russian leader won, and people said that the election was rigged and there was a massive protest and the protesters won and their guy came to power.
And in America, the widespread perception would be they were right, it was rigged. What is the perception? Is the pretty widespread popular perception in Russia the opposite? That, no, this was Western meddling, it's not so clear it was rigged, or what?
That's pretty widespread. I don't know if that's the majority opinion. Probably, I would guess, it's probably the majority opinion. It was a long time ago. I must have been like 17, 16. Mm-hmm. When it was happening, I had the feeling that this is beautiful, popular, pro-democracy movement, people taking charge of their faith, et cetera, et cetera. But as I said, I was 16, 17.
And is this the view of the 2014 revolution in Ukraine pretty much the same in Russia? Western
this is
engineered.
Different because this was not an election. It was right. Not a disputed
it was
election.
A coup. Whatever
word you use, a coup or a revolution, there was no transfer of power, right? There was no...
No democratic transfer.
Yeah, there was no... there was a president and the president fled. And prior to that, a whole bunch of stuff happened. And then you start arguing about who's to blame, who got the situation to that place. But it's clearly a different kind of situation. It's not that people voted and then they argued about how the votes were counted.
And is the perception in Russia pretty widespread that there was some illegitimate Western meddling in that?
Yeah, that's pretty widespread. Again, it's hard to gauge whether that's a majority opinion or not. And there's clearly, again, been involvement. We know that. Then you argue about what's legitimate, what's illegitimate. And there you get stuck because people pick sides.
Mm-hmm. And what about your perception of the... Again, there is no single Russian perception. But when we look at the things that have been going on in Ukraine... As Putin spins them, I mean, he's talking about a lot of persecution of ethnic Russians. I think it's true that the Ukrainian government has been reducing the role of the Russian language in some public schools. It's been closing Russian media, Russian language media outlets.
It went into effect, I think, pretty recently, and it was a weird, like the kind of language game they played there. The law is, it's not like against Russian language, the way it's phrased. It's that media outlets that are in foreign languages that are not one of the languages of, what do they call them? I forget the terms. There's a different law that preceded this one where there was a list of languages of like peoples who are historically the peoples of Ukraine, and Russians somehow didn't make the list, which is pretty weird.
Yeah, it is, because don't most, either a large number of, or even most Ukrainians at least speak Russian more or less, even if they're not native Russian speakers? I mean, it's a pretty common language, right?
Yeah. The further west you go, the less people speak Russian fluently, and some people don't speak it at all. But and the languages are very similar, and there are a lot of ethnic Russians in Ukraine. So that was weird that Russians didn't make that list. And then they passed the Souther Law, which said that every news media outlet that is printed in a language that's not one of those traditional languages of Ukraine needs to have a Ukrainian version in its full, like it should be the exact same thing, the exact same volume of information just printed in Ukrainian. And then there's this caveat added that this is a general rule except for English and the languages of European countries, of the European. So it's like you only left basically with Russian. So it's clearly a law against Russian speaking media, Russian language media, but it's phrased in this more vague way.
Is your sense that most Russians are buying Putin's view that there's really serious persecution of ethnic Russians going on in Ukraine? Now, he's using the term genocide, so he must be referring to more than what we've been describing. He may just be talking about ethnic Russians who have been killed in the kind of civil war in the Donbass. I don't know what exactly he means by that. I mean, first of all, do you know what he means by that? And
he's talking about Donbass, and he's talking about the other people who died during the 2014 situation. There were people who there was a building that was burned in Odessa, and people died there. He's talking about just Russians who died in the events since 2014. I need to make all these caveats. It's hard to speak on behalf of like the majority of Russians, what is the general opinion, but I think the general opinion, with the caveat said, is that the regime is anti-Russian, but it's not as dire as Putin makes. I mean, so as I said, so here's this law about Russian speaking media. So that's a fact. That's there. That's a sign. But from that to genocide is a pretty long way.
But when he talks about the persecution of ethnic Russians in Ukraine, I assume that there's some kind of substantial kind of Russian nationalist contingent in Russia that is very responsive to that message. There is a constituency there.
Probably. There's not a whole lot of political life in Russia. Like, there's, you know, it's not that there are debates between different factions.
Yeah.
You know, Putin has his people who, as I, you know, I described this theater of yesterday, where they all needed to say the thing without him prompting, without him telling what to say. Mm-hmm. And then as far as like opposition leaders, as I said, it's either jail or immigration or death. And there's no, you know, like, it's not like you turn on TV. There are people yelling at each other on TV, but It's only the people who were invited there specifically to yell according to the roles that were given to them. So you don't
that
have
itself
this.
Is not entirely unlike American TV, but still there is a much greater plurality of views expressed, I'm sure, in American media. Go ahead. Were you going to say something else?
So I'm just saying it's hard to gauge, like those Russian nationalists you're talking about. I would need to have some Russian nationalist friends to find out what they think. They're not present in the public sphere. 10 years ago, it was different. 10 years ago, there was this broadly oppositional milieu, and it included nationalists, included liberals, and you can get a sense of where they agree, where they disagree, and what they think. And now the landscape is pretty, they have it down.
People just aren't talking as much in public.
Yeah, you're not, yeah.
Now, I was assuming the nationalists would be pro-Putin, but the way you phrase that made me think I might be wrong. And I know that actually Navalny, and Westerners may not totally appreciate this, has in the past expressed some pretty nationalist themes. I mean, I think the West, we think of him as this cosmopolitan pro-Western guy. I think in some ways he is, but he has something of a nationalist history, right? So is it wrong to think, to conflate Putin and Russian nationalism so casually?
So I think, again, it's kind of hard to say because of how the landscape has changed in terms of how controlled it is. But I think the turning point was Crimea for the nationalists. Before that, there were a lot of people who were not happy, like nationalists who were not happy with Putin, but getting a chunk of previously Russian territory back into the country was something that a lot of people who were previously in opposition to Putin, they started supporting him because this is finally Russia's, gaining its previous glory and whatnot, and then historical justice. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the times I'm talking about, it was like 2011, 2012. Those were the first big pro-democracy protests. This was the rise of Navalny. And there was a moment of a broad coalition of people from all parts of the political spectrum where it was actually kind of beautiful to watch. There were a few of these events where it was like a conference of all people who agree that Russia needs fair and open elections. Mm-hmm. And then it's through elections that you figure out what the course of the country is going to be. And there were people there were like people who were maybe not Nazis, but not very far from that, and in the minority. And there were people who despise the Nazis, the nationalist people, and you saw them argue, and you saw them, disagree and explain to one another why the other one is wrong. But they were on the same, physically in the same space, and they were not mm-hmm. fighting. And there were even some, like I remember when the streets protests were happening. You could see a little like proto-society emerging. People were taking up the roles within the protest movements. And the nationalist guys, they were those are the football fans. Those are the people who can maintain an orderly line, can be on the lookout for the cops. They're, more organized, more militaristic, and they're doing that thing. And then next to them are these, feminists who are giving a lecture on sexist language or something. And they were, they wouldn't find each other in conversation ordinarily, but there was a brief period where they peacefully coexisted and had a common cause, which was fair and open elections. So it didn't last but long.
This was when again?
That's 2011, 2012.
Mm. Speaking of Nazis, do you hear a lot about how a lot of these Ukrainian nationalists, these anti-Russian Ukrainian nationalists are actually Nazis? I hear that claim every once in a while. Is that a widespread perception, or they're fascists, or they're this or they're that?
That's the government rhetoric. That's the line. How many people agree with that? Some do. I don't know. It's mm-hmm. again, I don't know. There's not like a poll that I can trust to gauge the perception mm-hmm. of the population at large.
So I guess, I don't know, in kind of moving toward toward the end of this, I guess for me, one big question was, first of all, do you think it's possible that the speech last night, as crazy as it sounded to a lot of people, actually was by and large smart politics? I mean, I'm thinking of Donald Trump, you know, like he would just, you know, especially at the beginning when I didn't really understand his constituency and what he was doing, he would just seem kind of like a crazy ranting person. And then I'd go, oh, this is actually working for him. He actually knows what he's doing. I mean, sure, tons of people think he's crazy, but he knows he's hanging on to the base he needs to hang on to become president. And I guess the first question would be, do you think there's a chance that Putin's speech falls into that category? And then I have a second question after that. But what does that make sense as a question?
So you're talking in terms, does it appeal to the people? Is there a constituency that appreciated that speech?
Does it appeal to enough people for the speech not to be a sign of actual craziness? In other words, like maybe even miscalculated a little, but still, basically, what he said last night is going to appeal to enough people for it to have been a kind of a reasonable political, you know, gambit.
I don't know. I would need to wait a little and talk to more people to gauge whether the perception that I've seen so far is pretty universal or not. I haven't seen anybody who was anything but worried after this. But then again, in the last, you know, like since COVID and Navalny's return, I don't know if he cares a whole lot about how appealing he is to the people. Like there is not, who's going to challenge him? So let's say people are worried and upset. How does that bring trouble to his reign? I don't see the mechanism for it. There's not going to be, I don't think there's going to be any kind of successful public protest or anything. I think people are going to stay home and, you know, those who liked it are going to say, I liked it. I don't know if there are going to be many of them. Those who are anxious and depressed as a result of that speech, well, they're going to be anxious and depressed, but there's not, I don't see a consequence on the home front for him. So yeah. I think the move is more like geopolitical. It's more what happens next in terms of what he does in Ukraine, what reaction he's going to get from the West, how he's going to react to the reaction. And that, I don't know. My guess would be is he doesn't, like he's open for many possibilities of how things can go down, and he's going to play it by ear as the situation progresses. I'm worried. I don't know what's going to happen.
And what has he done that, in your view, makes him more impervious to public opinion? Makes him so he's jailed Navalny, tried to have him killed. There's another guy who was like shot on a bridge who I gather was a problematic.
That was earlier.
That was a while ago.
Since Navalny's arrest, it was not just Navalny, it's also people who were like in some faraway region, they were in Navalny's, part of his organization. Some of those people were either jailed or left before they were jailed. There is this law that's been widely applied now about foreign agents. So this is if you're doing any kind of journalistic or activist, any kind of work in Russia that, you know, they deem socially important, and you have any kind of money coming in from abroad, you have to label yourself a foreign agent. And then there are rules like my Twitter feed has a lot of these. So if you are a foreign agent, you need to put this pretty lengthy, like a paragraph long description, like a label, this message has been produced by a foreign agent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that puts a strain on any kind of free media, because individuals can be labeled that, media, institutions can be labeled that, and everybody's a foreign agent nowadays. Everybody who's free.
That's funny. I remember talking to you maybe, I don't know, 6-7 years ago or something. And I think the idea was, well, Putin does, the government does exert a strong influence on what you see on like TV and that kind of media. It's not paying that much attention to the internet. The internet doesn't matter so much because it's mainly young people. And but it sounds to me, but and I remember thinking, well, it can't do that forever. I mean, the internet's going to matter more and more. It seems to me that it is doing more to influence internet discourse than it was.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah. There's, you know, those kinds of things. There's also, you know, in America, everybody's concerned about the Russian trolls. We got them first. Like, we got the fake people online arguing on the behalf of the regime here first. There is, when I refresh my Twitter feed on my phone, the images don't load up. And I think that's a consequence of the government intervention as well, because they said they're going to slow Twitter down.
You mean just recently, like that started? This started recently.
Been I don't know, a year, maybe 6 months.
Hmm.
They load up on desktop, not on the phone. But that was like they did say we're going to slow Twitter down, and there's like back and forth about you know, a push and pull with YouTube and stuff, because YouTube deleted RT in Germany. They're banned now. And then Russia says, well, we're going to ban, not exactly, we're going to ban YouTube, but there's going to be a reaction.
There RT hasn't quite being, been a reaction. I think it's Russia, Russia Today. Russia Today. Yeah. I mean, quickly on the Russian trolls thing, an asterisk, but I remember you saying something. You knew a guy who worked in what was the big Russian troll, the famous St. Petersburg. And I got the impression from you that it was maybe a less effective and powerful intervention in American politics than some of us might have thought. By his account, they were just being asked to
The original message I got from him is this was a stupid job. He was just posting burgers and flags and guns on some, you know, Texan page or something. But I have since heard an update that there has apparently been a change in the managerial staff, and now they're more coherent, and this is a more interesting kind of job. And it's this is only hearsay. I haven't had like an in-depth conversation, but I think the one guy that I've heard from said they're like have a more coherent approach to spreading conservative messages online
in Russia. Or both?
No, online in America. That's still that same front.
Because this was after the election, the 2016 election. And it sounded like at that point, his mission was mainly just to rack up numbers however he could rack them up without having to show that they had actually done much to hurt Hillary Clinton. But, anyway, so anything you want to say in closing about the whole situation, or what Americans might not understand? I think this helps us, what you've said already helps us understand it more clearly.
I don't know if I understand it very well. I don't understand what are the possible outcomes, like how the situation, so I get how Putin's unhappy with the world order. He wants some kind of a new world order. I don't exactly see how that can be accomplished. And I don't understand, like, what are the good strategies on anybody's part? How do you move in the situation to get it to a better, safer, more peaceful place?
Yeah. I don't either. He's calculating that. I suspect you know, I'm going to have a guy on my show eventually who a political scientist who writes about the what he thinks is the underappreciated role in just status considerations in international politics. It's like nations want respect. They want, you know, their perception of whether you acknowledge their status matters to them. Leaders, individual humans, we know want that.
Yeah.
I think Putin is somebody who thinks Russia's not getting respect and he's not getting respect. He's the leader of Russia.
He really wants it. I think that's
and,
one of the.
And he really wants it. Yeah. And again, nothing I'm saying about to say excuses his behavior at all. But I do think American policy has increased the chances that you would wind up with a Russian leader who thinks he's not getting enough respect. And I don't think it was necessary.
No, yeah, I agree with you on the, like, I mean, I would go all the way back to the, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union to the Americans talk about the victory in the Cold War. I think that's a problem. Like, the Soviet Union that collapsed, that was 6 years since Perestroika started. This was Soviet Union that was trying to get more open, more democratic. It was more open than Russia is now. If that country falls apart, that shouldn't be seen as a victory. That mm-hmm. that should be seen as, you know, fertile ground for more shit to happen down the road. And I think that the entire history since the fall of the Soviet Union has been mismanaged on the part of the US. But I don't know how that can be remedied now. Like, you know, I've heard you where I've read your newsletter where you say, you know, it's a pity that bargaining hasn't been done properly with Putin. I don't know if that's, you know, he did say that they've a possibility of a moratorium on Ukraine's membership in NATO was raised, and he was not happy with that because he's saying this is not anything. You're not really giving us anything because you yourself say that Ukraine is not yet ready to join NATO. So if you're saying it's going to happen sometime down the road, that's you're just saying we're going to do what we've been meaning to do according to our own plans. So you know, to go further than that, what Putin wants is a, you know, written down guarantee that NATO is not going to be expanded eastward. Now, I don't myself totally understand why NATO had to be expanding all these years eastward, but I also, I don't think a U-turn on a long-term strategy like that has been happening for decades, and now they're going to change that. Why would that happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, the politics in the West make it difficult. I mean, first of all, you're right. I think maybe he was offered a quote moratorium, which is a temporary thing by definition. Right. That's what a moratorium is. We were apparently not offering to rule out the possibility of NATO membership or have NATO issue something ruling it out or anything approaching that. And I think the politics of it are sufficiently difficult that that probably the realistic way that it might have worked, I mean, the politics in the West are difficult, that would be, it would have to be part of a larger deal. I think you'd say, okay, you know, I don't know, there'd be a lot of delicate phrasing, but mm-hmm. I think what would be great if you, I mean, for example, suppose you said to Putin, you know, he has his issue, I think rightly, with what we did in Kosovo in 1999.
Right. That's, which people say this was a major turning point. Yeah.
Well, it totally was. I mean, people say we're changing borders in Europe by force for the first time since World War II. No, it's not the first time, folks. Right. We did it in Kosovo. We did it without the UN's authorization. And that really got Russia's attention. We did it in 1999. Yep. So an example of what a larger deal might be is we say, well, look, let's have the people of Crimea vote on who they want to be affiliated with. And let's have the people in Kosovo vote. And probably and the people in Crimea would vote to be part of Russia. People in Kosovo would, you know, would vote to not be part of Serbia. And you would have settled those in international law. I, you know, I don't want to get into this too much, but I appreciate how delicate the whole thing is. And I certainly understand how the politics in the West made it difficult to just guarantee that Ukraine wouldn't become a member of NATO. At the same time, one reason the politics are difficult is because nobody talks about it. The whole American foreign policy elite, the journalists, the commentators, mm-hmm. the think tankers, almost none of them talked as if it was a realistic possibility. And that's why Biden didn't have much political space on this front. It's like a vicious circle. And half of the piece I just published in my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, is about that. Half of it is about kind of why didn't Biden offer this? But the other half is that why is it that our foreign policy conversation is so constrained that even though we knew this, you know, this concession might have a chance at forestalling invasion, nobody talked about it in America. There was almost no one advocating it. Almost no kind of respectable member of the foreign policy establishment advocating it. It's just the conversation is so narrow here. And that's one reason there isn't political space. I mean, it's not like there's a bunch of Americans who are against it. They don't think about this shit. You know, they just take their cues from the people on TV. And if the people on TV aren't talking about it, well, then it's a non-starter. But that's my own crusade, the problem with American foreign policy discourse. You've got enough troubles. So I guess I'll let you get back to them unless you want to say anything else.
If anybody can get me a visa to some Western European country, I would appreciate that.
Actually, I could be an important figure there. I've been your employer. That's what you need in these things, apparently. From the U.S. point of view, you need there's this type of letter you sign that is absurdly over the top in its praise of the person. I signed one of these once. This guy was coming from Canada and his lawyer said, here's what you got to sign. And it's like, this guy is so fucking great. If you don't let him into America, I don't see how the Republic survives. I'd be willing to say that about you. Meanwhile, where people can find your work is at your newsletter, Psychopolitica.
That's right, psychopolitica.com or psychopolitica.substack. I just published a new issue with weird selection of news from China with some art by other people that I really like.
Okay, and your Twitter handle is what?
Nikita S. Petrov.
P-E-P-R-O-V. Does that have dots in it or is it just continuous?
No, just Nikita S. Petrov, all in one word.
Okay. Well, thanks, Nikita.
Thank you.
Let's talk down the line.